Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about from the common cold to Ebola, including the Epstein-Barr, they're all viruses, and I'm going to try and give a sort of an update on it. Now, I am not a science communicator, nor am I someone working in the field. I'm someone who's reading about it relatively hard and coming up with questions, as I expect the majority of people out in podcast land fall into that sort of category. And sort of what happens is that I'm at a stage that where I see an explanation that's not quite right. I set it aside, look at it, sometimes in that pile of stuff, the explanation is a poor explanation, or I need another piece of knowledge to make it all make sense. So one of these things, you know, it's the obvious answer. It's like a crossword. You know the obvious answers out there, but some of the information you have isn't correct. You have some additional, as you're struggling to it, you bring in additional branches of knowledge that are not sort of so commonly held. So I've got a knowledge of molecular physics, molecular bonds, to see how all this sort of thing happens. So when a biological particle moves, I sort of understand how it moves and the energy system that it moves. So I've got some sort of amateur view there, or angle in there, which allows me to at least converse with people learned in the field. And so that's what's happened. I've met someone who's studying in the field, and you pick up all these bits and pieces. Now, is there an advantage to it? Well, yes, there is, because I've got sort of all this untended knowledge, and you just tend to put it together in sort of larger concepts, and you might be able to explain it, and perhaps listening to a variety of people, it's worthwhile listening to explain. Now, the main thing is that viruses are the enemies of cells, and cells are the basic units of life. So to understand what a virus does, a virus makes a cell make more viruses. That's the essential aspect. So a virus is a parasite of a cell, and the aim is to keep the cell alive, not to kill the cell instantly, but to get the cell to make baby versions of the parasite. So in life, you can have a symbiotic relationship. You can rely on another thing. There's mutual benefit. Or you can have a parasitic relationship where the host is not benefiting at all. There's not a mutual exchange. Or you can have a sort of an independent thing. Now, even humans are symbiotic. We're symbiotic with our gut flora. We go around and we eat stuff, and we basically don't feed ourselves. We feed our bacteria inside, which break things down. So there's that sort of thing. But to understand the drama of what a cell is, it's pretty much thinking about a house. It's a region in which a home, a region in which certain things happen. So essentially, a cell is a walled ecosystem in which things it wants. It's a walled container, basically. All cells are bags, and essentially it ejects things it doesn't want and takes in things that it does want. So essentially it's an environment which is an ideal world for a cell. So a cell, if it wouldn't require a world, a wall, if the entire outside world was perfect for it. So it's a bit like a house in terms of a house keeps the weather out, and you take in deliveries that you want. You take in supplies, water and stuff like that, and you put out the rubbish, and the rubbish truck comes along. So like a home is a live home if it's connected to the electricity and water, and essentially viruses are homeless bits of whatever they are, DNA or RNA, depends what they are. Essentially, you've got the information paradox, which I'd like to talk about. And they sort of are home invaders. They break in through the door, and it's essentially, if you consider the living room, the place where, or the kitchen table, the place where all the things are decided of what goes on inside the cell. This is what happens. Now, we've had a picture of the cell as a sort of a classic house. That we sort of have imagined the cell as a house, and perhaps there might be strings, you know, in the old houses, or very old houses in Australia at least, where they were rich pastoralists. They would have a little system, and what would happen is you'd pull a string, and in the servant's room there'd be a bell ringing, and you'd look up the bell and it would have the name of the person, you know what to do. So we've had our original view of the cell almost towards that level. There would be sort of a boiler room, we'd have a few sort of very primitive cells, but the more developed cells, there's the boiler room, kitchen table, all different things. There's a present folding room, if you like. There's a kitchen where things are prepared, all inside a cell. And our original view of the cell was it's along like that, but it's a bit more like Google Home or a fully automated system. So inside the cell, it's a bit like a Disney movie, like robots or anything like that. And there's heaps of action going on with lots of nanobots. In fact, the cell has got, you know, your Roomba bot. These are all powered by little battery packs. There's engine room inside the cell called the mitochondria, which is a bacteria, if you like it. Sort of, it's a, I don't know what you describe it, a symbiotic relationship. The mitochondria were in the wild, but they have come to always live inside cells. And a bit like calves giving birth inside a barn, they now entirely live their entire life inside cells. So it's sort of like a house cat. You could put them outside, they could survive for a very short time, but they really prefer to be, they're indoor creatures. And what they do is that we feed them munchy sugar and oxygen to keep them happy, pat them on the back, and they fart out these battery packs. And these battery packs go around the cell and power all the little nano machines, which then go around to pat them. It's sort of like a circle like that. So they're quite healthy. They're called mitochondria. Sort of write that down, look it up in the internet. And so our view of the cell is a lot more sophisticated now, in terms of that if it wants to get something from the top of the cell to the bottom of the cell, there's a highway built, a rail built, you know, quite literally a rail, a tubular rail. On the tubular rail is a little motorized. They're not wheels, they're a pair of trouser legs with a hook on them, and they pull these bags full of nutrients or whatever it is from one part of the cell to the other. And so the cell is alive, the cell is alive, and the cell is a little ecosystem, a little world, which has built up a layer. It's basically, in general, I think they're all water worlds, they're all little water drops. And they're basically, if you can imagine a pool, a floatable pool, imagine one of those kiddie pools, inflatable pools, with two layers on it. There's the one up the right way, and the one on the wrong way on top, making a sealed little thing, a little home. It's like it's a, so if you imagine a house, and it's absolutely full of water, Now, if it's full of water, you can't open a door on it. If you open a door or a window, all the water will rush out. It'll be a bit of a disaster. So what they have is a lock system. And it's a little bit more sophisticated. It's a lock system where the door is opened, you walk in, and then walls close in where the door used to be, forming a little bubble, and that bubble is then picked up by a nanobot and put along and carried to the required place. Or you're there in the little wall and you might be a bit of food. It's all okay. Oh, it's okay inside the cell. Actually, your disaster. Other little doors open it and start shoving in digestive juices. You've actually into the little barrel of them. And I suppose this is a time to actually talk about the information paradox. Or the information paradox I had is that all these nanomachines are basically proteins. Proteins are a polymer, amino acid polymer. So it's just basically a chain, a linear chain, garden hose of varying amino acids. And these 20 amino acids form up in a long chain. So essentially, if you can imagine out in your garden, you get your pack and you follow the instructions, the IKEA instructions, and it says it goes from 1 to 1,000,000, step 1, step 2, and all the steps are to the end of your chain, you add this, you add that, and essentially you wind up with a huge long string, and you have to then fold it up. There's some Rubik's cubes out like this, which are a long, basically long chain, and you fold them. So I rather like it. But you fold up your furniture. Rather than flat pack, it's string packed. All the proteins that come in string packs. So the little parts come up and then you assemble them into a string. Then you fold the string up into your various shapes. In general, the most popular shape is the globulin, i.e. a big messy ball. But you can get these other things, which is sort of, you can fold up a pair of pants. There's some walking doors, scissors, you know, all the basic tubes. You can all fold it up. Now these proteins are they're not bulky. They're flexible. They've got charge. They're either water repellent, water attractant. They've got sulfur bonds. They've got all these different utility tools. You've got 20 different proteins, and you can stack them together with different utility tools. And the utility tools might appear to work, but what happens is you fold them up and utility tools are opposite each other, or they can bend. And into these utility tools you slot designer molecules. So instead of the blood globulin, so the hemoglobin, that's what it's called, the hemoglobin molecule, the protein molecule, which is starts off long, folds up. I think there's four of them, four string packs are folded up. And into that you slot in some activators, which are the heme molecules. You can slot in molecules, or you can have a molecule with a protein attached to it. So that actually links into it, so you can have these. It's fairly sophisticated machines built up. But nonetheless, we have this problem that the actual packaging, as you would know, like often when something arrives, packaging is much bigger than the actual product that you make. And you've got a nice looking product and you've got a huge amount of packaging. And essentially, if you look at the molecule, it's that size, so 10 units long, and then when you look at the stuff that's made it adds up to 80 or 800 times more. I just can't describe how much bigger. Those numbers just came to my head. Because they're made, proteins are made by something called Ribose, nucleic acid. So ribose means a sugar. It's a basic sugar, and it's a sugar. The sugar is basically a it's like a plastic holder. You know, in when you've got your mobile phone or anything like that, it comes in a package, and that little plastic packaging is the sugar. And then there's a sort of piece of Velcro which sticks those plastic packagings together. And that's called the phosphates. And so you've got phosphate, ribose. And essentially, the ribose is a little bit bulky, a little bit loves water. It's a sugar. Sugars love water. They've got hydroxide atoms all over them. Oh, you're going to get into viruses pretty soon, because the viruses have the same paradox with them. So you've got all this packaging. So you've got the Velcros which stick the plastic boxes together, which are the sugars, and the sugars hold the product, which is the bases, and the bases clip together in a way, and the base just tells information. Bases are sort of like SIM cards. I can't quite describe it, but they then go into it. So you've got all this big bulky machinery. So you can imagine a massive factory. You drive past a batch factory. What's that? A mobile phone factory. The factory is huge and it produces these little products. It's like a milk factory, for instance. The milk comes in and it comes out in little bottles, but the factory itself is huge. That's for me as a computer person, a physicist, looking at the life equation saying, yep, I do understand it. And of course, you say, well, if I want, how does it all work? Because one of the things is that the factory eventually has to produce the machines to go off and butt off a second thing of life. The basic cell theory is that a cell can actually Xerox itself. We call it Xerox, photocopy itself, make a copy of itself. So essentially, your mobile phone is good and it dies, but cells are, if a cell was a mobile phone, you'd be able to put it in a, you'd say, oh crap, my mobile phone stopped working for a while, I'll just put it in the drawer. You open the drawer up and there's two little mini, or they're not, fully sized mobile phones coming out. This is great. And of course, this is how bacteria cause a great effect. Once they switch and send chemical signals on and saying that we're going to kill the organism now, and it's time just to multiply up to part of the reproductive cycle, saying that we're going to really super expand, go on to mass production because we've got to make heaps of us because it's coming, the end is coming. This organism's now, we've decided we've had enough of this organism, we're going to kill it. But we're going to kill it in a way that it will die and spread us about the place. So these bacteria can do this mobile phone trick where you put it in the drawer and two mobile phones. I might try that again, put it in the drawer again, multiple drawers, and you get 4, 8, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. 1,023, 2,046, 4,092. So I can go to. I'm not going to actually stress my head more, but it goes up at that ratio. Of course, what I'm trying to do also is get my brain back. So if I've had a big shock, and I've just got to really just push every day, push all my logic circuits to the max. Okay, getting back here. So you've got this process, but this process is, I have got these big things which produce little things. That's all they can do. So these big RNAs and stuff like that, the one thing they can't do is they can't build another factory. They only put out small things. And so this is an information paradox or size paradox, as far as I'm concerned. And it's not like one of these great paradoxes about the in a village, a man shaves, can shave everybody except himself, who shaves the barber. That type of ancient paradox, which is, it's not an artificial paradox, it's not a I'll stop press paradox, there's going to be an answer to it. And so recently I asked about this, particularly in viruses, that's the main thing, is that a virus, if you would like to imagine it, it's like a multi-stage rocket to deliver its payload. So at launch, it's that big, it fires up, the first stage goes off, the second stage goes off, you finally get the little thing into satellite. And that's okay. That little bit of satellite has to have all the information necessary to build the entire rocket again. How does that work? Because there must be some information problem with it. I can sort of describe it. And the same goes for sperm and other things like that, where you've got a payload and it's got a, sperm is basically like a germ, like a virus germ, and it goes along and it's got to do this payload. It's just got to deliver its payload. That payload has got to be really small, but eventually it's got to build another thing to deliver the sperm. So in this case, it builds eventually another man. The sperm goes off. That's got enough information in it to add some other information, and that builds another. That's excessive scale. This all sort of imagine it. So you've got that sort of information scale stuff. One of the things, I don't know, it's 4,400 picometers across is DNA, whereas proteins a tenth of that. So it's something to go across. Now the answer is that it produces heaps of these proteins, these mobile phones, or these tiny little milk bottles. You mentioned something small, it keeps on producing heaps of them. And the thing is that it then can assemble all these things into something bigger. And that bigger stuff eventually gets bigger than the factory which made it, and that can make the factory again. It's sort of an arc. It's sort of like it's a brick. It produces these bricks, and then the bricks can be put into a building, and not only to a building. It's not as though there's a big architect. There's heaps of science in it, quantum physics about how these building bricks go together, and they've got a small arc in them, going in a circle, and it tends to arc and stick together to make loops and all the structures. So that's a complex thing. So the virus is something which, although this is sort of a paradox for living things, cells are these living things. And so one of the things that they do is they're going to build a wall. And the way they build, I'm going to build a wall, I think that's what Donald Trump's building this wall, but cells have no problem doing it. And how they build the wall essentially is that if you make mayonnaise or any emulsion, you can make a drop, an oil drop, really, really small, and it will float. So this French salad is where you get oil and lemon juice and shake it up together, and it forms a very tiny particulate thing. Milk is another example of it. And essentially, you get an oil drop. So what you a cell is a water drop inside an oil drop. There you go. And the layer of the cell, which is water attractant, has an oil attractant side, and to that oil attractant side, you put another oil attractant surface. So the walls is called a double lipid layer. A lipid has got a water attractant side and a what is it? A water attractant and an oil attractant. So essentially, you've got an oil droplet with a water droplet inside the oil droplet, and and that layer of water attractant, oil attractant to water attractant. So you've got basically this skin, which is water attractant on both sides, but oil attractant on the inside, is your lipid layer. And you can do these fantastic things. You can, this oil layer, so you've got a really thin, molecular, thick oil layer in the center, and you can actually build rafts. It's pretty cool, rafts to go in these layers. So you can imagine it's like lubricated in here, so you can stick something through which is attracted to oil on the inside, and it's pinned to the surface. This is sort of a post-it note gone mad. I can't quite describe it. And you can do other things, like you can get these sort of building blocks and actually put a little porthole in it, really small, so the water just doesn't completely flow out, but you can get irons and other stuff to flow out. And essentially, to build all this, these things are built down the track by these ever increasingly large scale things. It's not, the whole factory is not large, but there's the components of industry, like the factory itself isn't large, but if you actually put all the components into one block and put them all together, it would be huge, and they're just going beep, beep, producing it. So what happens is you've got, it's like a industrial complex. So one produces it and feeds several clients. It's like a supply chain going down. To like, say you go into you go in to buy a can of baked beans, and you're pretty big, and you want a can of baked beans. And what happens is you get in a car, you travel to a supermarket, which is along a road, which is the cell equivalent down Tubulin, with a little, your little car is the vesicle and the diocene, if I remember the word, these little pant legs which walk along the cell. So if I can just put it aside as I'm going on here, you can imagine me as a scientist saying, I've got to go and do some teaching now, read the kids' textbook, saying, without thinking about the major implication of it, this just can't be true, because there is, if I just can't draw a diagram and say, voila, by the force of the education department, this works. There's got to be a reason for these sorts of things. And then do a bit of research, and you can imagine someone who hasn't been educated in this, and myself, this innocent conflict. But I mean, the sacrifice, you win nothing by not explaining it. It's a fantastic, it's like, it's not the cell, compared to, say, a crystal, where it stays the same for billions of years. The quantum mechanics is interesting in a crystal. Okay, there's band gaps, that's all interesting. You can go, but the cell is just blow your mind. You're sort of like, you look down this microscope at this, and or at the students' models, if they could actually see it, it's all this hopping nanomachines, all this complexity of quantum mechanics just beaming around. It is alive, you know. It's there's nothing. It's like, it's extremely interesting. But you have this paradox, which is basically solved, that you've got this industrial process producing these baked beans and or these small components. These small components are reliable. There's an economy. It's basically, the answer is, how does this all work? There is an economy of information, and this is how the viruses come in. So the viruses have this fundamental problem, as far as, which is the cell problem, but sort of magnified. So viruses have a general structure of a protein outer coat, which is like your calling card, like your camouflage, protein camouflage on the outside. It's like decorating a Christmas tree. On the inside, they've got a matrix cage, which is the piece of information I found out about it. And this matrix cage acts to compress the RNA and the DNA. So both the RNA and the DNA, RNA is water soluble, so it's got no problem. DNA's got heaps of problems. DNA really only exists fully functioning inside the nucleus because it's a micro world. But these molecules, RNA, DNA, they repel each other. It's sort of like, if I have a ball of string, Christmas wrapping, whatever it is, around Christmas time now. This little black bird in front of me, which is these little pest birds in Australia. In Britain, people love black birds, but we just absolutely hate them. They're sort of little parasitic black bird things. Okay, so if I had this string would repel each other. If I did let the string out of a drawer, it would fling out and float around the room. Repelling, gravity doesn't matter. These small scales, gravity doesn't matter. It's the string-to-string repulsion. So if the string repels itself, it will fill up the room. And if I open a door, it will fly out the door. So this is the entire thing. It's when you rupture the nucleus, the DNA just... It just goes all over the cell, and when you break the cell, it just springs out. It's super springy, which is a great thing because you can make DNA, and there's a special de-springing juice you can put in, which coils it up. But when that de-springer is removed, it re-springs, and it creates a DNA pressure. So the I think it's actually quite a high, in terms of atmosphere, it's quite a high pressure inside the nucleus. And similarly, inside a sperm, the DNA is not, you've got sperm A and sperm B. Sperm A is got a big container for the DNA. It's easy to push in. It's like it's like loading up the camper van, the caravan at the back. So a large caravan, you can put it in neatly, or you can get one of these fold down ones where you have to really ram it in, and it's okay. You've got the two things there, you can hook up a Ferrari to the little camper van, you can hook up a four wheel drive to the big one, because the big one's never going to reach there in time. It reaches the holiday site, which is the egg, and the one with the more compressed information or camping gear is reached there already. It's got the barbecue smoking, singers on, the music blaring. We're here already. And so eventually, of course, when it comes to next year, the next sperm produced is always that compressed stuff. So sperm itself, the DNA gets really, really compressed in. And it's compressed in so it can't function anymore. So for DNA to function, it's got to be able to be opened up. Enzymes have got to be able to waddle around it. And, all this stuff. It's actually quite a busy place inside the nucleus. But it needs a certain amount of space to operate. And also, what happens is the nucleus gets bits and pieces. And basically, if you can imagine, RNA is waste product, RNA is water attractant, this is the DNA, because it's deoxied, it's got all the oxygen, it's DNA, deoxied nucleic acid, it's rather oily, and so you mix a watery RNA that will squish out, so jet out. So you can imagine all these things are under compression. Now, going back to the virus is not too dissimilar to sperm, and it comes along, it's similar to sperm, it's got its molecular calling card. Now, sperm into eggs has got two layers and a double lock system. In general, it's only allowed one sperm in, so it's got to signal. Once the sperm's come in, it's got to be able to signal around the outside of the egg saying, campsite full, let's see what's going to happen here. And they come in, and you can imagine the egg laying back, oh my god, and the sperm putting all its DNA. Look, I just really, really think, again, this is something I don't quite understand. Does the sperm, it can't just throw its DNA, it's got to get its DNA into the nucleus of the egg. Because there's got to be other components within inside the egg, I would think. If the egg just can't say sit there, it's got to be alive. And an egg is alive. So you can, your sperm is alive, your egg is alive. So, like, sperm has to be alive. It's got to take in sugar, take in oxygen, and convert that to, it's got to have a mitochondria in there. So besides having that little packet at the top, which is its DNA packet to go in, it's got to have the flagellum, and it's got to have the engine process for it. So what I do understand is that it has to go through, and then this has to fuse with the nucleus and go through. So this is the basic reproductive pathways. So viruses, you can't fix a virus and then say you can no longer reproduce. Like you can, I could bet that you'd solve a viral problem by making people sterile. Perhaps. But essentially you've got this packet virus, and it's got, on the outcoat, it's got this container, like in the nucleus, that's compressing the DNA, because you don't want your DNA functioning inside it. And it wouldn't have anything to do with function. It doesn't have all the cell enzymes going around it, but I'm sure there would be a few enzymes in there. It's got just the basic package there. So it's basically sterile and dead. There's no actual, if you saw this, you saw the cell, it would be sort of like busy lights going on. If you could listen to the cell, there'd be all this noise and chatter. And the DNA is, sorry, the virus is a bit like a black ninja, going all silent, not much happening, got no food, got nothing. It's got to come in there and just make other ninjas which suddenly pop up. But the thing is that it's got to shed its skin. So it can either, it's got two ways of getting, hijacking the information process. It can, or three ways, not that I understand fully the HIV process, that when I read it, I look, I honestly get confused. So I can see how you can pop in the RNA. The RNA is quite good. So what happens is you go through your cell wall and it pops in, and it can produce some RNA. And the RNA has to be taken to the ribosomes, whatever it is. Or I don't know how it would work. But essentially it's got to start to have sufficient RNA there to produce the proteins, to produce the another complete copy of the virus. Or, say, as I found out with the herpes virus, is that it penetrates once and then it's got another cell, and it's similar to the spellers, the sexual thing, it's actually got to fuse in with the nucleus and get its DNA into the nucleus. Once it's in the nucleus, it goes across. And so this is a rapidly advancing field, and there's sort of two things that I've known of recently. One is the compression, you know, how you've got to compress DNA and RNA, and how the two can squish the RNA, or the DNA will shoot the RNA out because it's watery. It's also compressed, and you've got this compression thing. The compression is great because it stops it, the DNA just mixing. You know, it's because it's all compressed. It's sort of like I don't know, if you've got a suitcase, you jam everything in, that it doesn't just, your socks don't mix all over the place. So there's a lot of advantages to it. But you've also got this thing that you've got the virus component, the virus payload, under pressure. And so it is really like a hypodermic, this sort of nightmare thing where it shoots, it goes, it gets into you, and it ejects in a way. And you've also got to get, at the end of it, it has to trick the systems. The DNA, the RNA is producing, saying, is just slotting into the supply chain, the economy of the cell, and it's redirecting it. So the viruses do not have the information to make the supply chain. That is parasitically. These are the make all the enzymes, the building blocks that it needs. It just muscles in there and inserts its own blueprint at the last. It's sort of like a demon thing. It's sort of like coming in at the last moment, where you've earned the money, you've got the car, you've got the petrol, you've got the kids, you've got the shopping bags, you've read the specials, you know what you're going to produce, and all of a sudden you've got this other page of shopping list to do. It's sort of like getting it in the information at that level. So there's still a number of paradoxes, and it's still very interesting, and the virus research goes on just so many different fronts. It goes on the proteins on the outside, which is the immunology. You've got the actual mechanism, like if you can disrupt its spring process, the actual mechanics of it, and then if you can disrupt its the actual information sequence. So it's got a bit of a backstory, a bit of a story to it, and it's got this sort of secret play which is going on, and we've got to see if we can to protect ourselves from viruses, to actually see what we can do. The message is, of course, that it's no one knew at the time whether the huge, I'm not at all callous, but it was not at all answered. It was an article of faith that we should just put huge amounts of researchers into AIDS research. Something no one asked me about it. I haven't offered an opinion. But the end result of that is that we've got, not only have we solved the AIDS stuff, we've got these new angles on cancer and these other diseases which we didn't know we had. So it's sort of like a reward for the just, the open-minded. Whereas AIDS and the plagues and stuff like that were often explained in terms of supernatural terms and in terms of moral things. Okay. Science has actually been a little bit better. It's been a sort of higher grade, a higher level to say, well, let's project this forward. We can have this belief set, and at the end of it, we're going to have 20% of ourselves dead if we have all of this belief set. And at the end of that, we're going to still have a belief set, but with 20% people dead. So in addition to this belief set, can we have another belief set which allows us to progress to the same point with less people dead? It was sort of like this beautiful, beautiful view. And for sure, in the last 20 years, it has been one of the unexpected interest areas in that no one, or except the odd researchers that I talk to, no one is at all interested in it. So that's the background getting into it. And so I hope this generalized discussion where I've described things achieves two things for you. If you know this already, you can sort of say, oh, that's a bad explanation, but that actually has prompted me to get a better explanation. That's what I really, really hope for. That I don't think my explanations are really good, but I think as you're struggling to people who know what the real answer is and know my explanation, perhaps those two can go together to give a more informed nuance explanation of your enhanced stuff. That's one aspect. The second aspect, of course, is just throwing yourself at it, explaining it over and over again, and eventually you can speak for longer, speak more coherently, and eventually the little bits and pieces come together in the talk. So both these things, I don't offer this as any way a final point. It's sort of a midpoint for you, and the first baby step for me in terms of, it's not a midpoint, a reference point for you, but for me it's a little baby step going forward in explaining these things. And what may well happen is that education itself will shift, will move from its, life looks like a textbook page, because that's the easiest thing to print. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.